Stillman and Company is delivered by TriStar Moving, ESPN 1025. The game, 2 hours until first pitch, Vanderbilt, North Carolina State. Kevin Ingram going to join us in about, I don't know, 10 minutes or so. Kevin Ingram will be on the call. By the way, it will be great to talk to Kevin Ingram. I find him to be an incredibly talented guy. Let me say this. I watched the game Saturday. I watched the Vols yesterday. And I am into college baseball now. I mean, it's college baseball. It's kind of a drag a little bit, but interesting games, big situations. It's kind of fun. The NBA, by the way, is kind of in a similar spot, FYI. The NBA is kind of fun. Like, there's a little bit of fun this year to the NBA that's not, who's in the finals? Oh, LeBron's team in Golden State? Okay. Like, there's something to that. But championship teams do something that most other teams that just can't get over the hump just can't do. I was watching the Vanderbilt-Arizona game at the same time that I was watching the Brooklyn Nets and the Milwaukee Bucks.
Look at you watching college baseball and basketball.
I know.
You're a new man.
Let's get football back soon. There was one thing that happened in that game that didn't happen in the basketball game. And in the basketball game, I thought Kevin Durant won the game. Because I thought he was behind the line until I saw the replay where his foot was on the line. And it was a two that sent it to overtime. But if you go back to the the Brooklyn Nets, that game was all about Durant. Their only hope to win was Durant. Because James Harden was hurt, and Kyrie Irving didn't play, and they had a bunch of random guys out there, and God forbid one of those random guys do anything. Meanwhile, there's Vanderbilt. And Vanderbilt baseball has maybe the best pitcher in the country, perhaps a top draft pick in Kumar Rocker. And he got the ball in game one. And there is a feeling when you've got a Kumar Rocker to hand him the ball in game one of a College World Series, or if they make it to the final and they're able to turn him the ball in game one of that, there is a feeling you probably get as a coach that Tim Corbin probably felt pretty good about, even though Arizona was a really good hitting team up into that point. It just made you feel comfortable knowing you had your ace ready to go, and that your ace wasn't just an ace, but maybe the best player in the history of Vanderbilt's program, which, as we know, is saying a lot. Rocker didn't have his best start. 5 2/3, gave up 5 hits. 3 of them were earned. 3 of the runs were earned, 5 total. 7 strikeouts. He left the game as the losing pitcher. And when he walked off the mound, after giving up like a 450-foot bomb, I thought, uh-oh, Vanderbilt's in trouble. Dominic Keegan, the best player on Vanderbilt's team that's not a pitcher, the best position player they've got, made an error in the first inning. He was 2 for 6 in the ballgame, and he struck out in the 10th inning with a chance to end it. They didn't get a lot of help out of him. Those are their two best players. And I've always said, when you go into playoffs and people say, well, what if our ace pitcher doesn't deliver us a great start? Normally, you lose. Well, what happens if Derrick Henry gets held to 60 yards rushing against the Baltimore Ravens in a playoff? You lose. What happens? Somehow, because of Enrique Bradfield Jr., Gonzalez, Murphy, Maldonado, Carter Young, Vanderbilt found a way against the 5th national seed in the NCAA tournament. The Vols sent their best players to the plate in big moments, and they couldn't get a hit with runners in scoring position. In fact, in their game, when the game was either tied 0-0 or Virginia led 1-0, the Vols were 0-for-8 with runners in scoring position. They had 4 strikeouts, and 2 times they struck out with a man at third and less than 2 outs. That's losing baseball. You can't win that way, especially if it's your best players. But championship teams, when they are faced with adversity, get a performance or a play from somebody or something they didn't expect. And that's what Vanderbilt got on Saturday night. They didn't expect Luke Murphy to get the ball. Now, he's a good pitcher, but it's funny. He's Cousins. with a former Vanderbilt pitcher, Will Kleinert, who's a friend of mine. I played against Will in high school. And I was talking to Will during the game. And, of course, he was saying things like, I could throw up right now. He was so nervous for his cousin out there. He's like, it's way different than when I'm out there pitching. Way different. But, I mean, to expect him to come in the game with the tying run at second and could have easily gotten the save there, but to go the three innings he did and to shut the Arizona bats down and give Vanderbilt multiple opportunities to win it, that is the hallmark of a championship team. A team that when whatever your best is doesn't work, finds a way. That is how you win a title. When Kansas City got into the Super Bowl with Patrick Mahomes and got down, just like they got down against Buffalo, just like they got down against the 49ers in the Super Bowl the year before, just like they got down against the Titans, just like they got down against the Texans, they ran into that Tampa Bay pass rush. And they didn't have any other answers. There wasn't one of the running backs stepping up and taking the heat off of Mahomes. There wasn't the all-out blitz Tampa Bay brought and Tyreek Hill beating somebody deep to get him back in the game. There wasn't any of that. They didn't all of a sudden start throwing short. They tried to play their game and it didn't work. And I just think that in a lot of sports, it is so hard every day to have a good day. Chase McCabe is one of the most optimistic people I've ever met. Sometimes it drives me insane because when he talks about the Titans or the Predators, it is always glass half full. Or in his case, and I love him, but sometimes glass three-fourths of the way full. And I listened to him today talk about UT on Sunday. And he said, you know, the Vols just had a bad day. And then he quickly said after that, but you can't have bad days in this thing. And he's right. Vanderbilt did not have a great day. Vanderbilt did not play Vanderbilt baseball. They got the winning run at third in extra innings with less than two outs and their best hitter at the plate, and they don't bring him in? That is not Tim Corbin baseball. And they still won. The threat of the stolen base got them back in the game on the Carter Young home run. Because Enrique Bradfield was the tying run at first. Everybody in the ballpark knew he was going. They threw over three or four times. The kid from Arizona couldn't use his slider, and he put a fastball right at the knees, and Carter Young put it into left field seats. That right there is good baseball. That right there is a championship kind of moment. People often forget this because we all remember that Michael Jordan made the game-winning shot in the 98 finals. The Bulls won two other finals on last-second shots. Do you know who hit them?
I don't.
John Paxson hit one against the Phoenix Suns, and Steve Kerr hit one against the Utah Jazz. Think about that. Michael Jordan, greatest basketball player of all time, passes up to Steve Kerr to hit a game-winning shot. Passes up to John Paxson to hit a game-winning shot. The reason that's such a big deal is because once you get to the top, whatever it is you're best at, there's a chance that somebody else is equally as good. And I've always said in the College World Series, you can go through the first two rounds and you can feel pretty good about yourself. You can feel good about your pitching. Now go face Arizona's lineup. You can feel good about your hitting. You knocked over all those teams in the Big 12 and you ran through your regional and you just won two in a row of the Super Regional. Go face Mississippi State and their 21 strikeout arms. Good luck with that. You've got to have a plan when whatever your best is doesn't work out. The old saying is everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the mouth. On Saturday, Vandy got punched in the mouth and somehow, thanks in large part to their ninth place hitter, they found a way to win. That is the hallmark of a championship team. I'm not saying Vanderbilt's going to win the title, but I would say this. If they win tonight at 6 o'clock, I give them a 75% chance to win the whole thing. Because that's how unforgiving the College World Series is, unless you win the first two games of your side of the bracket. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. Kevin Ingram is going to join us. He's in Omaha. What he thought about Saturday night's game, his thoughts on NC State. Again, that game starts at 6 o'clock. That's next. We're live from the Wholesaling Studio, powered by RumbleOn.com. It's ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming on the Game Nashville app.
1-2, slow roller, it's through! Jason Gonzalez will win it in the bottom of the 12th, and what a night for the 9-hole hitter! Vanderbilt, 7, Arizona, 6. Heartbreaker for Jay Johnson and Arizona, as the number 9-hole hitter, Jason Gonzalez, comes up with his third hit of the night. They move to the winner's bracket.
Jason Gonzalez's performance, by the way, if Vanderbilt goes on to win tonight and take control of this side of the bracket, this kind of regional, and then ends up winning the whole thing, Jason Gonzalez's performance will be remembered. Now, that was the TV call. I was in my car. I heard Kevin Ingram lose his mind at the end of the Arizona game Saturday night. Kevin Ingram joins us now on the program as Vandy gets set for NC State. Kev, first of all, good to talk to you. Secondly, let's start with this, which is my kind of takeaway was, if I had told you going into the Arizona game you would get, you know, a 5 2/3 of 5-run baseball from Kamar Rocker, and Dominic Keegan would be 2 for 6 and commit a big error, what would you have told me? And then how it played out, what'd you make of it?
Yeah, Jared, great to be with you. Thanks a lot for having me. Yeah, you know, it was funny, in that sixth inning, Rocker got the first two out. It looked like he was going to breeze right on through. He sat down 15 straight, hit a guy on the foot, just barely got him, and then the next guy hits a two-run homer, and all of a sudden you're back behind by two after Gonzo had hit the two-run homer to tie it at 3. But, yeah, kind of uncharacteristic for Kamar, but he really did settle in after a tough first inning. Dominic Keegan had hits in his first two at-bats, but then they were able to find ways to get him out as game went along. But really just terrific relief pitching by Vanderbilt. Commodores got just enough offense, big two-run homer by Carter Young later on in the game, and then it kind of became a battle of attrition after a while, and Vanderbilt's bullpen did a great job working around some base runners and giving the hitters a chance and finally able to break through after stranding some guys on in those extra innings.
You know, it's funny, Kev, because I feel like baseball has gone, and I would maybe say Tennessee's an example of this yesterday, where they kept waiting for somebody to hit the home run. Like, they kept waiting for somebody to do that, and I go back to Coach Corbin, who is always going to play baseball the same way. They can change the game 8 ways to Sunday. He's going to stay the same. And I thought that the Enrique Bradfield base hit that made it 5-4, that put Bradfield on first, that set up the Carter Young home run, I felt bad for the kid from Arizona, because you could tell how rattled he was with Bradfield's speed at first base. And then all of a sudden lays in a fastball that Carter Young demolishes. And I look at that and I think, that is exactly why Tim Corbin wants Bradfield on first base. The threat of the steal led to Vanderbilt taking control of the game, and obviously a huge home run in that spot. When you were calling it and you guys were up in the booth, did you get that kind of sense that that speed really changed the entire complexion of the game?
Well, it really does every game when Enrique gets on base, because pitchers pay so much attention to him, and you'll see guys throw over multiple times, or he'll step off and look in that direction. Not everybody always throws over, but they always pay attention to him, which you have to. You know, there have been a couple times this season where it's like they forgot about him. It's like, do you not understand who's on first base? And the next thing you know, he's standing on third base because he either stole both of them, or he stole second, the catcher threw it into center field or something like that. But the speed, it does. It distracts the pitchers. Javier Vance can do the same thing when he gets on base, but you kind of divide that attention. You got pitching out of the stretch, and you know, all of a sudden, maybe he makes a mistake on a pitch where, you know, he might have been concentrating differently if Bradfield hadn't been at first base. But, yeah, you're right. Whenever he gets on, man, it's a big problem for opposing teams.
Kevin Ingram's with us. What do we think about NC State? I mean, I know what we think about Jack Leiter, but what do we think about NC State? Again, this is a team that got their rear end spanked by Arkansas, the best team in the country, came back, beat them, and ended up in Omaha and knocked off Stanford the other night. I mean, I watched a little bit of that game, Kev. They can swing the bat. They can run the bases. I mean, NC State, they may not be a national seed, but they can play.
You know, the thing about NC State is they just got off to a bad start in their season. They played really well the last couple months, but they were a team that was expected to have a good year, but they just started so poorly that everybody kind of forgot about them. And then you fast forward to that Arkansas series you were talking about. They get beat 21-2. In that first game against Arkansas, and you're thinking, okay, well, the Razorbacks are doing their thing, and they're on to Omaha like everybody expects, the number one seed. Well, then they come out in the second game. Sam Heifel pitches great. NC State wins it. All of a sudden, you're in a deciding third game. Kevin Copps goes out there and throws about 200 pitches and ends up giving it up in the ninth inning. And that was, to me, of all the things I've watched in this postseason, that home run that Torres hit for NC State against Kevin Copps was the most stunning thing of this entire postseason. It was like you could watch the Arkansas fans. It was like it just took the air out of the entire place. But, you know, going from that first game of the Super Regional where they're thinking, you know, in the back of their minds, we're a game away from being done, to being here in Omaha and playing great on Saturday, jumping out to an early lead against Stanford and getting the win there and playing in the winner's bracket on Monday night, I got to think it's a pretty fun ride for those guys wearing the red and black tonight.
What do we think about Jack Leiter in this game? I mean, earlier in the year when Leiter was just unhittable, I thought he could go into a big league game and start today, and I still kind of think that. But I look at Jack Leiter, and I think if he gives Vanderbilt the performance we know he's capable of, you know how dominating going 2-0 in Omaha is, kind of that regional setup. What do we think about Leiter tonight?
I'm really excited to see him on this stage, Jared. I mean, it's something you've sort of waited for the whole season, and you hoped you would get to this point to see if he'd have a chance to pitch in the College World Series. And, I mean, I think we all know this will be his one and only trip to the College World Series in his college career. Hopefully we'll see more than one start here. But he's pitched really well in the postseason. He pitched well against Georgia Tech in the regional, and he pitched great against ECU last weekend in the clincher in the Super Regional. So I expect a big performance out of him tonight. Yeah, you got to think there'll be some jitters. You know, I think there are for everybody who steps out here on this stage. I mean, it's a ballpark full of 24,000 people. It's a great scene, but I expect Jack to rise to the occasion and pitch really well. And as far as the situation, if you win this game, you go straight to Friday. And to me, you get Vanderbilt in that situation where you can probably come back with Rocker. Maybe it's a day shorter rest, but I got to think you'd come back with Kamara again on Friday night. If Vanderbilt can be fortunate enough to win this one, it would be really huge to come up with a victory this evening.
Kevin Ingram's with us. I would agree. I think the other thing, too, is in the bullpen, I mean, they really used – I mean, they stretched out Maldonado and they stretched out Murphy the other night. Do you think those guys with the day off in between, do you think Tim Corbin would feel comfortable about using them in a big spot tonight?
I think so. I don't know that you can stretch them out the way we saw the other night where they both went 2 2/3 and then you saw McElvain come in and pitch the 12. I don't know that you would see them go that far where, you know, they're around 40 pitchers or so. But I think if it's a spot where you can use them, I have no doubt that we'll see one or both of those pitchers tonight, especially with a day off in between. You know, and you think about a regular season situation where you play a Friday night SEC game and, you know, those guys do that sort of thing. Then they're back and you can bring them back out again on Sunday. I think the day off in between can make a huge difference. You know, the pitcher's got a lift in, got some conditioning work yesterday, and I would imagine that everybody's pretty much all hands on deck with the exception of Kamar Rocker tonight.
Kevin Ingram is with us. I was talking about Tennessee the other day, or today, and at Lindsey Nelson Stadium, the wall is 16 foot shorter on average than it is in Omaha. And we've seen teams that have gone out to TD Ameritrade and the ball just dies out there. We know that's not happening, especially with Arizona and Vandy the other day. But has Coach Corbin said anything about maybe changing the way he wants the team to play, given the fact that the home run is not as easy to come by in Omaha?
Well, the thing is, you know, like you said, the ball has been flying out of here in this College World Series so far. It's been really hot and the wind's been blowing out. This ball card can play a couple different ways. It can play really big where you got to just hammer one to get it out of here, or you can see some home runs. I think as far as the way Tim Corbin plays, I don't think that's going to change whether you're playing here or you're playing at a, you know, one of the smaller places in the SEC like you were talking about with Tennessee. I think this team just comes out and does what it does. I mean, it's really – this team's hit some home runs, but it's more of like a doubles team and using speed and – you know, you've seen it for years with Tim Corbin's program. Manufacturing runs, a lot of times, is the name of the game, especially in a close game. Get a guy on base, you bunt him over, you try to figure out a way to get him home. And I think, you know, with runs expensive like they were late in that game against Arizona the other night, I think Vanderbilt will just do what Vanderbilt typically does.
Last thing for you, Kev. What is the sign for Jack Leiter? When you know that Jack Leiter is on, what is the sign early?
To me, the sign for him is he locating the fastball and getting it in for strikes? And you know, so much is, you know, what's the strike zone like for the plate umpire? To me, that makes such a big difference, not just for the lighter, but for any pitcher for that matter. You know, how much can you get on one side of the plate or the other? But if Leiter is locating the fastball in good spots and he's really working off the fastball early in the game, to me, that's a great sign. He's got such a variety of stuff that he can throw, two different shapes to the breaking pitch, really hard slider, and then a 12-6 curve, and we'll throw some off-speed stuff. He's just got such a good mixture of pitches that if he can use that fastball and get ahead in the count, you know, especially early in the game, then, you know, it really keeps the hitters guessing.
Kev, enjoy it tonight. Again, I was listening to you guys on Saturday, and I knew you had to, like, bring it in a little bit at the end, but I didn't feel like you really could control yourself at that point. I mean, the excitement level to be, you know, all of a sudden you're doing the College World Series and Vanderbilt wins and extras. It's funny listening to the Carl Ravage clip, which I had not heard until we just played it, and then listening to you. The excitement on the broadcast Saturday night was obvious, and I think the Vanderbilt fans felt the exact same way. Have a great call tonight, Kev, and hopefully we'll be talking soon here in the future.
I hope so too, Jared. Thank you for the kind words, and thanks for having me.
Yep, Kevin Ingram joining us on the program. He'll be on the call tonight for Vandy baseball against NC State. And also, shout out to Kev, the new Vandy men's basketball voice, and he'll be doing the SEC Network Plus games, I believe, for Vandy baseball. So congratulations to Kevin Ingram, who, by the way, is one of the best. But I will say this about Vandy and Jack Leiter. And I think people sometimes are afraid to say something like this. You know me. I'm not afraid to say it. If Leiter is on tonight, and there's a big difference between him being on and him being off. If he's off like Rocker was the other night, and it wasn't that Rocker was just totally off. I mean, Rocker gave up a couple of runs in the first, gave up three runs in the first, and really settled in, and then got tired. I mean, I think it was pitch 101 or 102 that he threw that was his last pitch that got deposited into right field. If Leiter's on tonight, I think Vanderbilt's probably winning the whole thing. I mean, that's how big this game is for Vanderbilt. It's crazy because you don't know it, and Vanderbilt fans do because they've lived this. But that, and I said this at the beginning of the show, that tournament is so unforgiving if you lose early. It is so hard if you lose early to get out of the loser's bracket and get yourself back to the top. But as Kev brought up, if they win tonight, they don't play until Friday. It's Monday. Rocker started on Saturday. You could start Rocker on Friday. I think they'd start Rocker in a second game. I think they'd probably start Patrick Riley if it was NC State or Stanford going up in that, you know, kind of the elimination game for them, but not for Vanderbilt. But you could go Rocker on Friday, Leiter on Saturday, and you have a totally rested bullpen. Or excuse me, on Sunday, a totally rested bullpen. I mean, I find it hard to see Vanderbilt not getting to the College World Series final if they win tonight.
You're sure about that. However, if Vanderbilt does lose tonight, what are you giving their chances on making it to the final and eventually possibly winning?
We would all have to then, if you're rooting for Vanderbilt, pray for Patrick Riley. That, I mean, I think is kind of the situation they find themselves in at that point. But that's when, and I talked earlier about how the hallmark of a good team is when things don't go your way, figuring it out.
Right.
They probably have to hit their way to Friday night. And if they can hit their way to Friday night where they would get NC State again, then you're throwing Kamar Rocker. Then you're probably going up against NC State again. You're probably throwing Jack Leiter. So that's kind of the route they'd have to go. I mean, there's no doubt. They can win a game in this thing if Rocker and Leiter don't pitch their best. They can't win the thing if Rocker and Leiter don't deliver for them in these big games. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. We'll check in the headlines with Caroline. We'll do that coming up next right here on Stillman & Company. Hiller Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical. I love those guys. They do such a good job of taking care of my home, and I promise they can do a great job taking care of your home. I've now been using Hiller for 3 years, and I absolutely love them. Summer weather is here, and this is the time of year when your AC system is working overtime. If your unit is nearing the end of its lifespan, or you're starting to have trouble keeping your house cool enough, now is the time to replace it. Hiller is offering special financing on HVAC systems this summer. Get a new system installed and pay zero interest for 60 months. That's right, 60 whole months. Do not wait. It is a miserable outside right now if you don't have air conditioning. Do not wait until you're uncomfortable. Go ahead and ensure you're ready for those peak temperatures. Visit happyhiller.com for all of the details. As always, happy you'll be, or the service is free. Hiller Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical, proud supporter of the Preds and the Tennessee Volunteers. Hiller, call the Happy Face Truck today. Stillman & Company, ESPN 94.9 is the home for National Sounds baseball. Tomorrow night, the Sounds return to First Horizon Park with a six-game series against the Charlotte Knights. Sounds baseball on ESPN 94.9, presented by Farm Bureau Health Plans and 312 Pizza Company. It's time for Headlines with Caroline.
We're spanning the sports world. It's Headlines with Caroline on Stillman & Company, right here on Nashville's best sports talk,
ESPN
102.5 The Game and the Game Nashville app.
The Ally 400 was this weekend in Nashville. It was a huge turnout. It was a totally sold-out race. More than 45,000 local households watched. Kyle Larson ultimately got the win. He drove the number 5 car. The winner of the last race in Nashville 37 years ago, also number 5 car.
So Bobby Labonte?
It was not.
Terry Labonte?
I know how much you love him. Jeff Bodine.
Who is that?
Well, I know that you are a die-hard, lifelong NASCAR fan.
Yes.
So I'm intrigued that you don't know his name.
So is 45,000 households a lot? Like, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, obviously not a Titans game, but that's not fair to equate that to. Like, is 45,000 Nashville households for a NASCAR race on NBC Sports Network, a channel that's going to cease existing in about 5 minutes, is that good? Like, I think it is good.
I think it's good. I mean, it's, like you said, you're not, if it's a 45,000 households watching the college football national championship, that's probably not the best numbers they've ever had, but it's the first race in a very long time in Nashville, like you said, on a network that is soon to be gone. I think it's a great thing. And I think that 45,000 households tuned in, and also so many more people in Nashville who maybe not have tuned in, they at least knew it was happening, they were at least excited about it, and they at least were part of the conversation, whether they watched it or not. So I think that it was a big deal for NASCAR. But also, there was a certain familiar face in the crowd this weekend. Alvin Kamara.
I did see this.
On Sunday, was named NASCAR's first ever growth and engagement advisor. So Kamara will, quote, this is from the NASCAR's press release, he will work directly with NASCAR leadership on strategic planning and creative opportunities that support its fan development efforts. So basically, Alvin Kamara will be an advisor that will help NASCAR grow its fan base. Pretty cool for Alvin Kamara. Now, he said, you know, all I've ever known is the NFL. So it's kind of cool to have my own little office. I have a little key. It's nice to have a job that isn't football.
So, I mean, sure. I'm sure Alvin Kamara will do great. I look at this, though, like Alvin Kamara, I believe, got into NASCAR last year when they got rid of the Confederate flag.
He did.
I think that was like, okay, if you get rid of the Confederate flag, I'll support you. And now it's like become its own thing, which is good. I mean, I think NASCAR is right to want to expand out from its base. You know, like the NFL is the only sport that doesn't truly have a base. Like everything else is somewhat niche. Now, I feel like the NBA, if you've got nothing else on and there's a LeBron James, like that can become, because you know, it's about LeBron and Jordan and like everybody can talk about that. But even that now has kind of become niche. People that like the NBA, like here in Nashville, I don't think it moves the needle much. Like I'm
no,
sure people
it's like
watch.
It's West Coast, East Coast, I feel like.
Right. It's like a major metropolitan city kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is where the NBA is. Baseball is a bunch of old peepops who fall asleep with the game on and their teeth sitting next to them. And it's like maybe baseball needs to work on these initiatives to get more people to care about them. I give NASCAR credit because the one thing that something like that's ultimately going to do is it's going to make people uncomfortable. It's going to make fans of NASCAR uncomfortable right now. If you were to poll 100% of NASCAR fans last year and you were to say, do you like the Confederate flag at a NASCAR race? I wonder what the results would have been. But I guarantee you it would not have been 100% against it. And the reason I say this is because there are going to be initiatives that NASCAR needs to make to get more people interested in the sport. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't ever see myself giving one poop about NASCAR, ever. Like, my kid could race, and outside of my kid dying in the, you know, racing,
come on.
I cannot see myself, like, actually interested in NASCAR.
If your child raises cars, you won't care.
Like I said, I'll be holding his mom's hand, praying for dear life that he makes it out of every single one of his races alive. Or she. Like, I will be praying. But no, I find the sport to be so boring. It's just a car going in a circle. And I can never get over it. And I
understand. It's a car going 200 miles an hour.
And I get it. I get it. You can say the same thing about every sport.
I know.
You can say baseball is like, oh, it's just a guy, you know, stands out, scratches himself, gets back in. The pitcher spits. You know, hold on. Got to spit again. You know,
got to fix my gloves.
Right. Like, I'm sure you can do that with every sport. But I have no interest in NASCAR. And I hope Alvin Kamara does a great job with it, but I'm not anticipating that I'll ever have much of an interest in NASCAR. But good for NASCAR to get the 45,000 people to watch.
Yes, and who knows what Alvin Kamara, what he will bring in, how he will change it, but at least NASCAR is trying, and that is not something that I've been seeing the MLB do. Also this weekend, we had the U.S. Open. John Rahm won the U.S. Open, his first major win, and he is the first Spaniard to win the U.S. Open. So, crazy finish to the U.S. Open. He had two birdies on the last two holes, won the U.S. Open by one stroke against Louis Oosthuizen. Kind of practice.
Louis Oosthuizen.
Yep, that one.
Oosthuizen.
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 There you go.
There it is. I practiced it, I promise. This was the first time in U.S. Open history that anyone has birdied the last two holes and won the U.S. Open by one shot. And this is cool news for John Rahm because he was so close to winning at the Memorial. He had tied the 54-hole record at the Memorial. He had a six-shot lead but had to withdraw after being notified that he had tested positive for coronavirus. So this kind of felt like a statement win. Like, not only is this his first major win, not only is he first Spaniard to win the U.S. Open, it was like a, okay, hey, this wasn't a one-time fluke. I can do it again.
I'll say this about the U.S. Open. Am I the only one that feels like the U.S. Open is easily the least important of golf's majors? Like, it kind of feels like it's the least important of golf's majors?
I mean, it's not the Masters.
And it's not the PGA.
No.
Like, British Open, U.S.
Torrey
Open.
Torrey Pines is really pretty.
Like,
I would put it third behind over the PGA, I would think.
I think that's
you
fair.
You put over the PGA? I think PGA's a big deal.
Maybe.
I think PGA's a big deal.
Maybe so.
I mean, maybe I'm just kind of out of it. Good for John Rahm, though. He's on a heater, huh? Like,
yeah.
I mean, you know, guy would have won the other tournament, wins this tournament. Like, he's kind of on a heater. Where is he, like, in the world? Is he, like, 20th, 30th? What is he?
I don't know, but I want to say he may be number one in the world.
No.
Number one in the world? I don't know.
After winning one U.S. Open? Like, Martin Keimer won a U.S. Open. He's going to be number one in the world.
I don't know.
I mean, he might be. He legitimately might be. What's next?
I don't know. Tennessee State is working to try to become the first HBCU with a D1 hockey team. So Tennessee State is working with the Preds, the NHL, and the College Hockey Incorporated to make a plan with possibilities and a bunch of studies to figure out how exactly this can and will work in the future. They're meeting today. So we'll kind of see the outcomes of those studies, see the takeaways that the Preds, Tennessee State, everyone who has been working on the inside of this plan, see how that would go moving forward and cost, scholarships, equipment, facilities, so on and so forth. And Sean Henry has been a big part, president and CEO of the Predators, has been a big part in moving this initiative forward at Tennessee State. He said, what we're taking on is hard and what we're taking on is big. When we are successful in pulling this off, it might turn out to be one of the most transformative steps our game has taken in decades and decades and decades. I mean, I can't disagree with him. I think that the Predators have done such a tremendous job in bringing hockey to the city of Nashville, a sport previously nobody, I don't think, really cared about. So would be huge for HBCUs, which would be huge for the game of hockey if this comes to fruition at Tennessee State.
I think this is kind of similar to NASCAR and the initiative basically that, I mean, hockey's a white sport. Like, I mean, feels like, you know, it feels like every time that you see, like, a PK Subban or something like that, that it is great for the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I had friends that when the Predators had PK Subban and Wayne Simmons that weren't even huge hockey fans, but were like, okay, now I'm down with this. I am with this. I am for this. And I would say that, you know, NASCAR is in a similar spot, obviously. Mm-hmm. Baseball has done a lot of work over the years at kind of being more of, or at least they've tried. Like, baseball is weird because baseball's gone the opposite direction. Baseball, you go back to the superstars of the 80s and the 90s, and there were a bunch of African-American superstars. Ken Griffey Jr., Barry Larkin, Doc Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, Joe Morgan. Like, I mean, just, and yet it doesn't feel like it's that way as much anymore in baseball. I do think this. I think that people have got to understand that unless you're willing to help others, unless you're willing to be the first person to step out and say, we're about this and we're going to do that, like, once you do that, you're not going to see direct results day one. So even if the Predators put a lot of money and a lot of resources into helping TSU get a hockey program off the ground, you're not going to see 3 years from now every HBCU having a hockey team. But I do think that 20 years down the road or 25 years down the road, it would be a much more inclusive environment. And I think that's what sports should strive to be.
I agree. And I think that I'm with you. It's not going to be a quick thing because it's not going to instantly make people who previously were not interested in hockey instantly, you know, super fans.
Sure.
But it's that first step for people to realize, okay, there is a place for me here. There is interest in my community. And I think that's a big step.
I would love to know, when all is said and done, how important P.K. Subban was for the Predators fan base. Like, when all is said and done. Because it was at the height of when they were winning. So you have a team that is winning that everybody in the town was talking about, and the most recognizable player on the team, at least as far as the country was concerned, was P.K. Subban.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a big deal. I think that is a big deal that will pay dividends for the Predators for years. And I think it's, you know, to me, I think that the more inclusive we can be, the better. In every sport, NASCAR, baseball, golf, hockey, every sport. Those are headlines with Caroline. Speaking of sports.
We talking about sports here?
The NBA. Yes, we're one of those sports radio shows that doesn't pride themselves on not talking about sports. We like talking about sports. I don't know about you guys, but I have poo-pooed on the NBA for a long, long time. And rightfully and justifiably so. But there's something about the NBA this year that I'm kind of digging. We'll get to that next. Stillman and Company, it's ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Now Embiid trying to back in. He lost the ball. Kevin Huerter gets it. Up ahead, Danilo Gallinari. Gallo breaks in. He jams! And the Hawks lead 98-92 with 41.5 seconds left. And Doc Rivers just had to call his final timeout. Doc Rivers just used his final timeout, and the Hawks lead by 6, 98-92, 41.5 seconds to go.
Phoenix's Jay Crowder to inbound in the front court. They advance and gets it into Booker. Unguarded, got all the way to the basket. There is no help, and he slams it home to make it 118-114.
There you go. Let me say this. I'm not an NBA guy. Never have been, probably never will be. I mean, I used to like Michael Jordan. I liked watching Kobe and Shaq back in the day. I used to be kind of into it, but never a huge NBA. I used to be a huge baseball guy as a kid. I mean, would watch baseball just every freaking day, and I still watch a lot of baseball. Obviously, I'm a huge NFL guy. Used to be a huge college basketball guy, got kind of burnt out on it both by working in it and by being in Louisville where they taught college basketball every day. Never been a huge NBA guy other than, you know, I've followed it, been into it, whatever. I love this weekend. I will say this about the NBA. Now, you got to do what I've told you to do, which is you got to start watching. If a game starts at 6:30, you got to tune in at 8:45. You know, give the game 2.5 hours. Forget about the first quarter. Forget about the second quarter. It could be 99-0 after two quarters, and there's a chance the other team will come back and tie it at the end. But these games, I've been tuning in with about 7.5 minutes to go, and they have been just thrillers. I mean, I watched Atlanta and the 76ers. Those games were great. All of them down the stretch were awesome. The 26-point blown lead in Game 5. The comeback by the 76ers in Game 6. The shot Trae Young hit. Oh, my goodness. And then last night, Trae Young made a huge play, and I was like, oh, Trae Young might be my new favorite player in the NBA. And about seven people that had apparently been wasting their time watching the whole game said to me, and they go, Trae Young's been terrible today. I don't know what you're talking about. Trae Young, I don't watch that. The second quarter of an NBA game does not matter to me, and it should not matter to you. But these games in the fourth quarter are freaking awesome. You know, the Milwaukee Bucks and the Brooklyn Nets the other night, that game was freaking awesome.
It was awesome.
That was awesome. Now, there's a lot of stupid basketball in there that I can't do. Like, Ben Simmons can't make a free throw. I can't do that. The second thing I can't do is, I don't know if you saw this, but deep down inside, I wish I could go back, move Durant's foot, like a foot back.
It was just like a smidge over the line.
Like, just count it as three, because Brooke Lopez was dumb enough on the other side to not know how many seconds were left on the shot clock out of a timeout with 7 seconds to go. You deserve to lose. But the NBA has been kind of interesting. And here have been my knocks against the NBA. The first knock that I've had against the NBA for a while is ever since LeBron went to Miami, or maybe, I don't know what started the whole super team thing. I don't know if it was Boston trading for Ray Allen and Kevin Garnett, or if it was LeBron going to Miami. But at that point, 2008, 9, 10, throughout, it's been all about the super team, except for the Spurs. It's been all about the super team. That's it. Just get as many good players as possible and go try to win. And I am grateful that the super team developed this year, the Brooklyn Nets, are out. I'm glad, because I don't like super teams, and I discourage them. I like teams. The second thing that bothered me about the NBA over the last couple of years is I feel like fundamentals have totally gone out the window. And it's like, well, forget about fundamentals. Let's just shoot threes and block shots all day. And I don't like that. Well, I'm watching this kid for Atlanta, Huerter. I mean, he is a baller. And then you got Ben Simmons, the first overall pick, and the guy literally cannot hit a free throw, to the point that his team is basically criticizing him after the game that he can't hit a free throw.
So bad that all that was on ESPN TV, ESPN.com, everything today was talking about a potential Ben Simmons trade away from Philly.
Yeah, because he sucks. Like, I mean, Ben Simmons is a bum. He is. And he's in, like, that max rookie contract, and he cannot hit a free throw. And it used to just drive me insane about the NBA. The lack of, and it's where Michael Jordan hurt the game by being so good. Because everybody wanted to do everything Michael Jordan could do. But they don't remember that Michael Jordan hit six threes, I think, in the first half of an NBA Finals game against Portland.
Jeez.
Like, Michael Jordan could play every position on the floor and be okay. And this guy can't even make a free throw. Like, he can't make a free throw. Now, I still have some issues with the NBA. Devin Booker for the Suns scores about 87 points a night, plays no defense. Like, I'd like to see there be a little bit more of an emphasis on defense. Like, I watch Milwaukee try to put P.J. Tucker on Durant. Everybody in the ballpark knows who's getting the ball, and he can't do anything about it. I'm like, this is where, again, going back to Michael Jordan, this is where Michael would raise his hand and say, I got him. You know, I got him. And I don't see Giannis Antetokounmpo doing that. And he's not a good free throw shooter either. But I don't like the super teams. I don't like the lack of fundamentals. And I, for the most part, have not liked the predictability that the NBA had for a five-year stretch where the finals every year were Golden State and LeBron's team. And even though that was kind of fun, the second Kevin Durant got to Golden State, it was a waste of everybody's time, and it was awful. And this year, you can't say it's been predictable. Who thought Boston or the Lakers would be knocked out in the first round? Who thought the Atlanta Hawks would be in the Eastern Conference final? I mean, the Hawks might win the Eastern Conference. Like, there is a legitimate chance. Like, I am not sold on Milwaukee after watching the end of their games and watching Giannis choke and watching Middleton clearly not be a superstar. The Atlanta Hawks, like, that crap organization, might be in the NBA Finals. And they might have a chance to win it because they might be playing the Suns. And normally that's bad for business. Like, it's bad for sports when you have, like, two random run-of-the-mill teams that make it to the championship. But for the NBA, where parity has been lacking for years and years and years, I think it's a good thing. So, again, as long as you don't waste your time, unless you're betting it, You know, if you bet like first half point score, like things like that, fine. But unless you're betting it, there is no reason to watch the first quarter, second quarter, or third quarter of an NBA game. But if you're like me and you're watching these fourth quarters of these games, they've been pretty good.
It has been really fun. And I will say the Bucks would not be in this position if Kyrie Irving did not get hurt. I think James Harden, whatever, take him out. If KD and Kyrie were out there on the court together, the Bucks would not be in the position that they're in.
Yeah, but Kyrie's such a loser anyways. Like, who cares?
You just think he's a loser because he complains in press conferences. He's a good basketball player.
When was the last time Kyrie played the Bucks in the playoffs? When he was at Boston. And remember how he basically checked himself out of that series because he got embarrassed? Like, he got embarrassed in that series. Kyrie, of all the things I don't like about the NBA, Kyrie Irving is everything that I don't like about the NBA. He is selfish. He makes ridiculous statements. He clearly doesn't care about playing basketball. He's addicted to social media. He's always hurt.
KD loves social media.
He's all about these super teams. Yeah, but at least KD can ball. Like, KD, like, almost single-handedly put his team into the Eastern Conference final the other day. Kyrie, I can't stand Kyrie Irving. And again, you could say if the guy's not hurt, he's always hurt. I mean, if Anthony Davis isn't hurt, the Lakers are probably moving on and Phoenix is probably out. Instead, Phoenix might win the NBA championship this year. Like, I would say if I had to bet on one team that I felt the most comfortable about winning it, it's Phoenix right now.
They're my favorite.
And if Anthony Davis plays, the Lakers probably win that series. So we can say that about anything. But again, I just love the fact that in a league where parity, like, that's all the NBA has been lacking, is parity and new players, and it just feels like it's the same. And this just feels so different. Oh, my goodness, does it feel different. It feels so much better. Oh, my goodness. By the way, Ben Simmons, oh, that guy, he stinks. I mean, like, if you can't make a free throw, I don't want to hear anything else.
Well, Ben Simmons is good at the things that aren't sexy. He can block, and he's really good with assists. And that's not sexy things to watch. Those aren't three-pointers. Those aren't, you know, draining shots, whatever. He can assist, and he can block, and that's what he's good at.
So you're telling me basically he's Dennis Rodman?
Yeah.
He can't shoot. He can't really shoot at all.
He can't shoot.
Neither can Rodman.
He can't, yeah, no, and he can't be. I mean, Rodman was one of the best defensive players in all of basketball.
Right. He doesn't have the same kind of type of drive Rodman has.
No, but he has that same kind of style of play, and that Ben Simmons cannot be the only person to carry a team.
Like, well,
he cannot
Ben Simmons,
be a LeBron. He cannot be a KD.
Well, Rodman, I mean, Rodman was never somebody to carry a team either. Like, Rodman was never going to be like, okay, guys, give me the ball and get out of the way. Like, that was never Rodman's game. Rodman played with those guys, you know, with the Pistons and with the Bulls, but
right.
Rodman was never. I mean, that's the thing, though. It's like when you're taking number one overall, you're not taking number one overall to be Dennis Rodman. And it sounds like he's Rodman without the mean streak inside of him. Because that mean streak, while Rodman also was a little crazy, Rodman also, like, he couldn't care. He'd D up anybody, anytime, anywhere. He'd throw down. And I don't think Simmons has that in him. 615-737-1025. The Supreme Court today ruled about college sports. Is it the end of college sports as we know it? That's next. Tillman & Company, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming on the Game Nashville app.